couldn't possibly live with me for any length of time. Because the more sober I got, the more I stunk inside. Even though I cleaned up the outside, I still stunk inside. So if I was just in AA and sober, I'd rather be dead. So I want to tell you something. There's a hell of a lot more than here than just not drinking. Because over here is the way that we people find our way to eventual living with the higher power after we die. See? Many normal people, they get up in the morning and they live a good life and they go to bed and they get up on church and they go to church on Sunday. And theirs is a direct route from here, from birth to there to death. Straight, even road, they have no trouble. They just go along that road and they wind up from here to there and they're happy. And they die good and they leave nice lives. But we're alcoholics and we suffer from a very real physical disease. Very real. And it causes our mind to be diverted. And it causes us to do things that we never want to do. And then the guilt drives us mad and we go for more and more and more. It's a rat race. The rat race of alcoholism. The more that we do, the more that we need. The more that we take, the more that we do. And then we wind up. So our path to the end over there is very devious. It goes that way and that way. Sometimes it comes back and goes across and up there. But eventually you get to the same place the normal people do. Because we try. And that is the name of the game. Trying. You could call Alcoholics Anonymous attitude. It's your attitude that's important, see? So if you come into AA and look for the whole ball of wax, that's what you're going to get. Now we were ready for step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. A lot of people say, yeah, I'm ready. Go ahead. And they wait for a little magic wand to hit them on the head. And it don't happen. They're the same people. They just sit there and they wait. So how that the man upstairs removes these defects of character is that he brings them to your attention. Now you've got your conscience in the back desensitized with alcohol. Now it becomes sensitized again, comes back to life. And as you go through life, you know that you're doing the wrong thing. And pretty soon, you know, you get confused. And then you have to ask God, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. See? Now, you take your fourth step. You look at your fourth step and you see your defects of character. And you look at them and you say, do I want them? No, I don't want them. Very few people want them. I only met one person in AA said he had some that he wanted to keep. I said, good, keep them. And if he ever gets sober again, I'm going to ask him, how was it, you know, when you kept them? If he's lucky enough to get sober again, he got stinking drunk about a month later, and he's still going as far as I'm concerned. So I wanted rid of mine. I said, oh, yeah, I don't want no part of them. So how that he removes them is by making us aware of them. You know, you'll start one day to say something nasty to your wife again or to your husband, and you'll stop and you say, no, wait, that's a character defect. See, that's something that I do that I shouldn't be doing. So you pull yourself up short. And the guy upstairs will always put them right in front of your face like that. Now, if you like gambling, bam, here comes all the gambling that you want. People are inviting you to go to the racetrack or here, or they want to sit in a card game. It comes there and you push it away and you say, no, I don't want none of that. And it goes away. And it comes back again, just like a carrot on a string. See? Push it away, here it comes back. Push it away, here it comes back. So finally you get the idea and you say, oh, out of my life, that's it, finished. And it's gone. And what happens then? Here comes another one. See? Another carrot on a string. You like dancing girls? Man, you're going to see dancing girls all over the damn place out there. They're going to be ringing you up on the phone and falling down in front of you. They'll be all over the place. And you say, where the hell did they all come from? Where were they when I was drinking? You know, but here they are now. Because the guy upstairs is going to put them in front of you until you say, that's it. I don't want no more. And when you do, that goes. Then here comes another one. You're a thief. You're going to find money in the street. When people are going to leave money on the counter. You're going to have money all over the place. And if you pick it up, well, you're not in AA. And until you learn, and the rest of your life, you're going to be fighting character defects. Because they're always there in the background. And if you relax your vigilance just a little bit, then boom, they're going to be right in front of you again, and you're going to have to make another decision. No, back there. I don't want no more of that. See? And that's the way life goes on. See? And that's step number six. And Character defects are things that you're doing that you shouldn't be. And then we come to step number 7. We humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, what are our shortcomings? A lot of people say, character defect is this, shortcoming is that. A shortcoming is those things that we are supposed to be doing and aren't. Now, it's not simple. A character defect is things that we do that we're not supposed to be, and a shortcoming are those things that we are supposed to be doing and aren't. What are we supposed to be doing that we aren't? Well, I have heard many, many people in AA come into AA and say, I just can't get along with my kids. They bother me, they annoy me, and I just want to love them, and I can't. They're just a nuisance. And that's a shortcoming. You're supposed to be able to take your kids and put them on your lap and give them a bath once in a while, take them out to a ball game, whatever you play up here, I don't know. You take them to the circus. You're supposed to be able to live with your children. And if you can't, why? Because that's a shortcoming that you have. And you're supposed to be able once in a while to tell your wife, hey, you sit down and I'll clear the table. See? Or you're supposed to go and do things that normally you don't know that even you're supposed to do. You have to learn how to live. And these are where your shortcomings come into play. So you humbly ask him to remove your shortcomings, and he makes you aware of them too, just like character defects. And then we go on to step number 7. Or number 8. We make a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The big thing in that step is to not look at step 9 when you're doing step 8. Because if you look at step 9, you will never do step 8. What happens is that you say, well, I can't do it, so I won't make the list. That's wrong. You make the list. Whether or not that you can do it is unimportant. The thing is, again, we go back to attitude. What is your attitude? Are you willing to do as you're asked to do? So you sit down and you make a list and you put everybody on there that you have injured. Now, it don't mean people that you have been embarrassed with or, you know, because making amends is repairing damage. So I have never, ever gone up to a doorbell and ring a doorbell and a guy come out and say, I'm sorry, I did this to you. That, to me, is not making an amend. Making an amend is repairing damage. Now, I damaged my wife's life. I damaged my children's lives. And no amount of apologies is going to repair that damage. It takes something for me, actual work for me, to repair the damage. And many people come into AA and they say, well, I hate my kids, so I'll buy them a bicycle for Christmas. That is not repairing damage. That is not helping children. Children need a lot of close attention and supervision, and the alcoholic is the one that doesn't give it to them. And then he comes into AA, and he goes blithely along the same path, and the kids get kind of upset again, and he tries to buy his children in a lot of cases. You don't buy children. That's not making amends. They need to be disciplined when they need it. They need to have a regulated life, and they're supposed to get it. They're supposed to be supplied with all their needs and shoes. And if you don't have money for shoes for you and the kids need shoes, then the kids get the shoes. That's the way that it works. You see, you come last. Because when you came in, I hear people in AA, I'm amazed. They say, I put me on the top of that amends list because I hate me more than anybody. And I say, you better go out and come in again because there's something wrong with your head. You came into AA and you got the greatest gift that God could give any human being. You don't need anything else. Your life is in the hands of the guy upstairs and you got everything that you need. You don't need anything. Who the hell are you to get amends made to you? You don't make no amends to yourself. You take care of other people and the guy upstairs will take care of you. So you make the list whether or not you can take care of people on it or not. You just put them down there because a tremendous thing happens when you make a list. Gets it out of here and on a piece of paper. And you'd be surprised. You go to bed at night and you sleep. You say, well, I can't do anything about it at the moment. But at least I've done something. I've put it on. I've got a list. And you ask yourself the question, if you would make a man, if you could, would you? And if the answer comes back yes, then you've done the 8th step if you've made your list. That's all there is to it. Then we come to the 9th step. Make direct amends to such people wherever possible. except when to do so would injure them or others. See? Now, what I have to say here is that I owe a whole bunch of money. I owe a whole bunch of money. I've stolen more money probably than most people see in a lifetime. And I can't go back to banks or loan agencies or nightclubs. Or I just can't go back and say, hey, I'm the guy that knocked you off, you know. I'd go to jail. There's no reason for that. It won't help anybody. Won't help me, certainly. What it would have done would be injure my wife because she needed every dime she could get when I got sober. And when it came back to paying back little loans, I went out and I got a second job because I didn't feel it was right. I deprived my wife long enough by drinking. And so I went out and I got a second job to take care of my bills. That I had my own bills that I had drinking and borrowing money and what. And I got a second job in order to pay them. And I didn't think everything that I earned on my first job I gave to my wife to raise the children. And I went 14 years without buying a suit. And it got to the point where my wife would say to me, hey, Jack, you know, you go to meetings and you speak and you got that old bag on you there. And I said, what's wrong with this suit? See, my first suit came from a morgue. Yeah. One of the group called me up one day and he said, hey, Jack, you know, why don't you come on over and see me? This is Bill. And I said, where are you, Bill? He said, over in Kings County Morgue. I said, what the hell are you doing over there? He said, I work over here. I said, oh, I didn't know that. I said, what do you want me over there for? He said, well, we got a guy in this morning, and he's just your size. And he's got a nice suit, a blue suit. Why don't you come on over and see if it fits you? And I went over there, you know, and I said, my God, Bill, do you think we ought to be taking a guy's suit? He said, well, geez, he ain't going to need it anymore. He don't need it. And he said, go ahead, have it. Only had a little hole in the back here, in the pocket, where he got hit with a truck. That was it. It was full of blood in it, but it washed up nice, it cleaned up nice, and I had a suit. As long as I kept my jacket on, it was all right, see? And that's the way I went. And that suit lasted me a hell of a while. And then one time my wife said to me, you got to get a new suit. You look like a, you know. So I went out, and very reluctantly I bought a new suit. Very reluctantly. Because I felt that with all the money that I stole and all the things that I had done and I'm taking welfare checks right out of the kids' mouths and taking milk right out of their mouth, I didn't feel like I deserved anything, nothing. And that's the way I still feel. I don't have anything that I need. I have everything that I need. I don't have everything I want, but I got everything I need. And that's the way it's been with me, and that's the attitude that I have. So I took that step, and I made direct amends wherever I could. I went to my brother one time. My brother came to me, and it was a long time. He used to say to me, hey, Jack, you still running around with that bunch of nuts in AA? I said, yeah, Jimmy, yeah, I still run around with them. And he said, boy, why don't you spend a little more time home with your wife and your family, you know? And I said, well, my wife and my family are in good shape. They're all right. They're happy. And he said, yeah, but, you know, you've been away a long time. You're out of the house, or you're in jails and prisons, and why don't you stay home and really enjoy yourself? See, you don't understand. He didn't understand. One day he came to me and he said, hey, Jack, I'm on strike. He was an artist. He painted some beautiful stuff. But for a living, he worked for a newspaper, and he did retouch work for a newspaper. And he said, we're on strike, and been a couple of 3 weeks now, and I don't have, you know, too much behind me. He said, you hire a lot of people on your job. I hired a lot of people, cleanup people, you know. I was working for real estate companies, and I had contracts for cleaning and maintenance and whatnot. And he said, how about you put me to work? He said, you hire a lot of people. He said, I could push a broom for you or something. And I said, all right, good. I said, but I tell you what you do. You go and you bring up your easels and whatnot, and your paints, excuse me. I got a few cartoons that I'd like you to do for me. So instead of you pushing a broom, you do the cartoons. And he said, really? I said, yeah, do that. So he come up there, and he sat in my office, and I put him in a corner of the desk and his easel. And I told him what I wanted, and he made me up about 25 beautiful cartoons about this big. And they were all framed, and they're on the wall down in Sobriety Unlimited in Mount Vernon, New York, yet. And they're beautiful. For instance, one is where a bunch of people stand, a guy laying in a casket, and one guy is saying to the other, he sure looks good since he stopped drinking. See, that was one cartoon. And then they're all in that order, you know, alcoholic jokes. And it was good. So while I'm there, he said to me one day after a couple of weeks, he was leaving. Strike was over, he was going back to work. He said, Jack, I want to say something to you. I said, what's that? He said, you know, I never knew what you did. He said, but while I've been here, I've been watching your phone ring. I see this kid Mickey come in and out, you know. I saw him when he got here with no pants, and you give him a pair of pants, and now he's working, he's happy. He said, I never knew what you did. He said, you do this all the time, do you? I said, yeah. He said, damn, I'm proud to know you, you know, just like that. And I said, is that right? Yeah. I said, well, that's good, a different attitude. And I said, you know, you're still running around with that bunch of nuts, Jack? He said, no, no more of that. He said, now I understand you. And he sent me a very lovely letter after that. And he said, for the first time in my life, I understand my brother. And it was just shortly before he died, see. And he never knew that he was not on the payroll. I never put him on the payroll. I wasn't that. I paid him out of my pocket, one half a week. That was it, boom. And I paid him out of my pocket. That's the way that I made amends to my brother. See, for all the nasty, rotten things I had done to him, all the bad mouthing I had done to him. And I never said, well, you know, Jimmy, here, I'm going to pay you this and that. No. Let him work. Let him think he's earning a buck, and he did earn it. I got my cartoons, and he got his money, and he paid his rent at home. And when he died, him and I were very, very close friends. And he loved me real good, and I loved him real good. And you see, he was only 52 when he died, and he died of high blood pressure. And I often think of him, and I think of him. He left two lovely children, a lovely wife, you know, and here I am, getting my brains kicked out and cops shooting at me all over the place and running mad and being beat half to death and sleeping in the streets, and I'm alive. And he's dead. And if I were to stand and ask the guy upstairs why, well, then I wouldn't be right, see, because mine is not the question. I'm alive, and I'm alive for a reason. I'm alive to be here this morning, talk to you people. That's what I'm here for, see? And that's the way that it is. And he's dead because the guy upstairs wanted him. And my mother was dead, and there was nothing I could do. And Sam Cohn told me, I said, how did I make amends to my mother, Sam? She's dead. She never threw me sober, and I feel pretty bad about it. He said, hey, there's a whole bunch of other mothers laying around here, you know. And he said, ah, he's got a mother. He's got a mother. You help him, you help his mother, right? Do I have to be your mother? I said, well, not really. I'd like it to be. He said, well, put your likes where you, you know, forget your likes. Your mother knows what you're doing. You don't have to tell her. You don't have to write a letter to the Holy Ghost. And I said, well, okay, that's your attitude. And this was a little Jewish fellow, too. He was a pretty smart cookie, this boy, I tell you. And he died, too, just before Bill Wilson died, 2 weeks. And I missed him good. Because all my life, I knew that Sam was there. And he was a very funny little guy. I tell you, when he called me up one day, and he was crying. And I said, what the hell's wrong with you, Sam? He said, oh, Gene's left me. Gene with his wife. And I said, Gene has left you? I said, that's ridiculous. Gene wouldn't leave you. He said, but she did. And I said, where is she? He's in Cincinnati. What's she doing in Cincinnati? She's there with my son. I said, ah, she's for a visit. No, she left. So I said, well, give me the number and I'll call up. So I called up Gene and I said, hey, Gene, the old man said you left him. She said, he what? I said, he said you left him. She said, well, I did, but only for a visit. And I said, you going back? She said, yeah, but I told him I wouldn't come back till he cleaned up the living room. And I said, what the hell's in the living room? She said, well, you ought to hang up the phone and go over there and find out. She said, because I can't live no more with that man if he don't clean up the living room. Now, he was a sign painter, right? Sign painter. And somewhere along the line, he got the idea that he wanted to paint other than signs. So he got big easels, and he started painting ships. And when I went over there that particular Saturday morning, you couldn't walk into that living room that was covered with ships. There must have been 200 paintings of ships on the walls, on the floor, under the, everywhere. And I said, Sam, what are you doing over here? He says, well, I like ships. I said, well, there's no reason to have that many of them, you know. And finally, he'd get rid of the paintings. He'd put them somewhere, and she'd come back home again. She said, oh, that damn old fool. See? An amazing thing. That woman was stony deaf. She could hear on a telephone with a big, heavy amplifier she carried. And the day that he died, her hearing came back. Most amazing. Because he used to lead her about, see? And the day he died, both her ears cleared up just like that. She could hear. I don't know why. You see, this guy upstairs is funny. He does a lot of strange things. Well, anyway, that's step 9, making amends. Then we go on to step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Step 4 and step 10 are different. Step 4 is when that you come into AA and you don't know where to start. You got to get started somewhere. Step 4, big bang. Because as you go on in sobriety, things keep coming back to you. Keep coming back to you, things that you didn't remember at when you were doing step 4. And if you keep going back and doing step 4, you're going to make a lifetime vocation out of it. And it's not what's needed. You'll neglect the rest of the steps. So what you do, you take step 4 one time. And then as these things start coming back to you, you'll be driving along, you remember something that you did a long time ago. You take care of it then with step 10. And when you walk along in the morning and you're ready to snap at somebody, you say, that's wrong, I can't do that. And if you do, then you turn around, you apologize right then. You say, hey, I shouldn't have done that, I was wrong, I'm sorry. Don't let it go. And I would say at this point, too, that all these steps are geared for the alcoholic. Selfish program. Because if you go to bed with something on your mind, something that you've done in step 10, you've been wrong and didn't admit it promptly, you go to bed that night, you don't sleep. And when you don't sleep, you get up the next day, you don't feel good. And when you don't feel good, how do you get to feel good? You take a drink. So these steps are geared to help the alcoholic. Nobody else, just the alcoholic. Other people benefit, of course, but we help ourselves mainly. So when we're wrong, we promptly admit it for our own benefit. That's step 10. Then sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer and meditation, a lot of people get upset. They don't know what meditation is. Meditation is simply thinking. Thinking about you. And I meditate always the same way. I put myself in close contact with the higher power. I do that by counting my blessings, you see. I have so many blessings, it's impossible to believe. But I count my blessings. And when I do, my thoughts always go back to the higher power and my first day in AA and how fortunate I am to be alive. And when I put my mind in that chain of thought, in that train of thought, then everything becomes easy. I ask my friend upstairs, let me go on just a little bit longer. And whatever you want me to do, make it clear to me because I get kind of confused. And what I'm supposed to do, let me know. And tell me what that you want me to do and make it very explicit so I don't make any mistakes. I haven't got much time left for making stupid mistakes and starting over again. So before I do anything, I always meditate just a little bit. And I ask my friend for guidance for that particular day and that particular problem that I have. And praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. While I lay in a hospital not too long ago in the intensive care ward, and I had a very severe heart attack, and one of my arteries to my heart just closed off completely. And it was a terrific amount of damage to the back lower part of my heart. And I lay there between life and death, and I was very alert in my mind. I was aware every minute of what was happening. And I watched that damn beep machine up there, beep, 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 and I waited for that to stop a dozen different times, you know. And all through it all, I kept a good contact with my friend upstairs. And I said, what's going to happen here is either I'm going to get out, or I'm not going to get out. period. That's it. And nobody knows except the man upstairs. And the doctor used to come and he'd tell me, you know, you're going to be all right, Jack. It's going to be fine. And I didn't really care. It didn't bother me at all. It didn't bother me, not even a little bit. The only thing I was concerned about was three meetings that I had lined up, two in Canada and one down south in the States. And I said, I can't get to them meetings, I'm sure. So I had to cancel three meetings, and that's the first time in all my years in AA I've had to cancel a meeting. I couldn't get to them three. And I said to my friend upstairs, if you want me out of here, get me out of here, but don't let me be a vegetable. Don't let me sit. Give me the strength to go and do what you want me to do. And you know, he did. Because I got out of there, I couldn't walk from here to that chair. I couldn't move. And I no sooner got out of that hospital than it was snowing, and snow was up to there, and windows were covered with snow. I went home to my home, and I was home for about 2 days. And I couldn't cook, I couldn't do nothing, and I thought if the damn boiler ever goes off, I'll be in trouble. Because it was below zero, it was very cold, winter weather. And it was when I was in that condition, my wife was working, my wife is no longer here, she decided she didn't want to live with me any longer. And what happened was that she was taken to the hospital in an emergency operation for gallbladder 2 days after I was home. That left me in a house covered with snow in the middle of winter, unable to cook, unable to get to the bathroom, unable to do anything, all by myself. It was pretty weird. Pretty weird. I called a few friends in AA, and they came over on the way to work and on the way home from work, and they called me on the telephone. They kept in touch with me. But what happened was that I had to physically get from there to the stove to get a cup of coffee. And I did it. And I crawled. And I got to the stove, and I breathed like I was going to die. And I said, if this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it's going to be. And I finally got to the bed, and I was able to get in the bed and get out of the bed. My wife came back 2 weeks later, or 3 weeks later, and I was able to get around to the house, you see. And then when the spring came, I got out on the sidewalk, and I walked a half a block. And I sat down for 2 hours, and I walked back. And then I sat 2 more hours. And then I went back, and I walked another half a block. Because, you see, if there's a will, there's a way. And I was not going to be tied to a damn wheelchair. See? And pretty soon I would walk 2 blocks, and 3 blocks, and 4, and 8. And then I went over to shopping centers where they were air-conditioned, and she dropped me off in the morning at work, and before she went to work, she picked me up in the evening on the way home, and that day all I did was walk through shopping centers. I knew every counter. I knew every sales girl, every salesman. I knew that shopping center like the back of my hand because that was my lifeline, you see. Now it gets to the point where I went to the doctor and I asked him, hey, Doc, I got a trip to make. Can I make it? And he said, I'll tell you next week. Come back in and we'll give you some tests. And I went back in, and he tested me, and he said, yeah, you can make a flight. Try it. See what happens. So I went back, and I started going and traveling again to my meetings. And I've been traveling ever since. I don't have any problems because I have turned my life and will over to the care of God if I understand him. And I'm not going to stay in this damn world 1 minute after he wants me, and I'm not going to go 1 minute before he wants me. So I ain't about to worry about it, you see. Because at night when I go to bed, I take all my troubles and I tell my friend upstairs, hey, friend, I got to get my sleep and you're going to be up all night anyway. So here, hold them for me till I get up in the morning. If you pray, don't worry. And if you worry, don't bother praying. I mean, it don't make sense. But that's the way that I live. Now we come to step 12 and I know the seats are getting hard and I'm going to get the hell out of here real quick. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Very big order, but very simple to do. Having had a spiritual awakening, what is a spiritual awakening? I never had a spiritual experience, but a spiritual awakening I had. Because to me, spirituality, a spiritual person, is a person that is wanted, needed, and loved by his actions in the world, those close to him. Now, if you're spiritual, the people around you love you, and they want you, and they need you. Now, certainly, my being here is an indication to me that I am living a spiritual life. Because people want me, they call me to come, they paid for my ticket to come up here, so I'm wanted, needed, and loved. So I'm doing fine. And that is what the steps of AA do for you. They make you spiritual. Nobody in this world can make amends to people they've hurt and not have them people turn around and say, well, he's a pretty nice fella. I guess I do love him. You see? So it's to our benefit to put these steps into our life because then we become spiritual. And after we have a spiritual awakening is when we come to realize that we are not sick, helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholics, but that we are in AA and that we're sober and the guy upstairs has a job for us to do. That's all that a spiritual awakening is to me. And I have had that spiritual awakening. And having had that spiritual awakening, it was very important to me to help the newcomer when he came through the door to get the same thing that I got when I got here, understanding. So I always keep an eye on the door for the newcomer. Because he is the most important person in the room. Without him, I'm dead. Because if I don't help people and keep my spirituality alive, then I too will die. Guy upstairs will say to me, are you tired, Jack? Come on up here. I don't want to go yet. I like it here. I'm having a lot of fun. I enjoy my life. And I don't want to go any time before. I'm going to do anything to precipitate anything that I don't want, you see? And try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Practicing these principles in all our affairs is very simple. I used to think that do unto others before they do unto you. That was the way I lived. And then I had to come into AA and I changed that around a little bit. And do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You see, I was all screwed up in my head. So now, if I can't help you, I won't hurt you. Guaranteed, I'll never hurt you. I will turn around and I'll walk away before I'll hurt you. I won't even argue with you. Because if I argue with you, you might come out second best. And if you come out second best, you might be at that point in time that you can't handle it. And you might go and seek relief in a bottle. So I won't argue with you. And if you have an opinion, that's your opinion. God bless you. God bless you. I hope that it's the right opinion, but I don't want to have any cause for any animosity to anybody. Because when I came to AA, I was a pretty sick fella. And nobody ever corrected me and jumped down my throat, and I said some pretty stupid things, too. I was a pretty dumb fella when I got here. And what happened was that people tolerated me. He tolerated my ignorance and hoped that I would grow and change. And thank God I did grow and I did change. And I look back and I see how tolerant people were of me. Because my attitude was, if you didn't like AA, well, then I'll take you out in the back and I'll knock the brains out of you, see? That was the way I was. Don't talk anything that's wrong because I'll belt you, see? My hands went quicker than my head. And people used to say, Jack, we don't do it that way no more, see? And I say, well, why not? It's quick and easy. You know, we don't have to put up with this nonsense from this bum. I'll take him outside and dump him. And Jack, please, forget about it. We'll handle it. And I couldn't understand their attitude, you know. But now I do, because they didn't want to do what I don't want to do now. So my attitude is, if I can't help you, I won't hurt you. Now I'll tell you one more thing and then I'm going to shut up. I woke up this morning, as I wake up every morning, and I looked at the floor, and I'm in a very lovely place. I'm living there with Brian, and he's got a whole room. I don't know where the hell he's sleeping, but I'm sleeping in a very nice bed with an air conditioner. I hope he's doing it good. And it's beautiful. And I woke up this morning and I counted my blessings and I said, gee, I had a good sleep and I feel good. And I woke up at 6 o'clock and I took my pills. See, I take pills. If you ever see me taking a pill, they're not pills for, you know, stupid pills. what they are for my heart, because my heart don't go too good. And I take a pill and it regulates my heartbeat. And I got to take them pretty precisely. So I took one at 6 o'clock and I laid back a little bit and I said, isn't it nice? That's a nice fella, Brian and Mike and all of them. And then I said my little prayer. See, the minute I put my feet on the floor, I got to get in touch with the guy upstairs. Because now I've slept, I feel pretty good. I got a big day in front of me. I got a whole 24 hours just for me. And I should be dead, and I'm not. And don't think I'm not grateful. So when I say I woke up this morning, that's real good for me. I'm very happy I woke up. And I told my friend upstairs, I'm sure glad you give me another day, because I got a lot to do today. And I said my little prayer. And I don't think there's very many mornings that I miss my little prayer, because I can always find a little time to say it. And it says, I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best, and his presence comes like a sunrise, like a glory in my breast. And all day long that presence lingers, and all day long he stays with me, and we sail in perfect calmness o'er a very troubled sea. So I think I know the secret, learned from many a troubled way. You must seek him in the morning if you want him throughout the day. And when I get that little prayer in my heart out, you know, it's a beautiful day. And I don't care if it's hot or raining or, like Brian says, there's going to be a tornado or something tonight. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. But I don't care. It's a beautiful day. And you're beautiful people. And I love you for being here. And I want to thank you all for listening to me. Now, before we close, I would like to say this. If there's anybody that has a question on anything that I've said, please ask it. And no question is stupid. If I've said something to confuse you, let me know about it, see? And I'll try and straighten it out. Now, is there anybody that has a question? Nobody at all. Okay. It's 10 minutes to 1. My God, did I talk all that long? I'm sure that it was somebody else. Must have been him. It wasn't me. You don't leave your kids in the hands of God, because God is not their father. You are, see? And there are certain things that you have to do as a father. This is one of the moral obligations in step 4 that you've mucked up on, see? As a father, you have moral obligations to your children and to your wife. As a husband, you have a moral obligation to the husband. You have moral obligations to your neighbor. So these are the moral obligations that he talk about in step 4. It's not sex in there, filleth moral inventory. So now you have to find out, what does the father do? Because obviously you don't know. I don't know either. I didn't know, I should say. And I had to go to somebody that knew what the hell they were talking about. And I always say that if you want to take a good fourth step, what that you do, you find somebody up the street that when you were drinking, you hated his guts. And you know why? Because he was always right. His kids always had shoes. His wife was always happy. He polished his car. He cut the grass on his lawn. When Christmas came, he took his Christmas tree down, not in July, but in December. A guy that always did the right thing. You hate his guts. And his kids are nice. Well, that's the kind of guy you want to take your fourth step with. Not with, but look at him and say, why am I different from him? That's your fourth step, the difference. Do you see? Now you're sober, go to this guy. Or go to somebody that knows and their children are good. Go to him and say, hey, what I do in this situation? And lay it out to him, because we can learn from everybody, particularly normal people. Hey, go to him and ask him, and that's what you do. Yeah? Find out what a father's supposed to do and do it. Very simple. Okay? Do we have any other questions? Huh? Does that answer yours?
Yes,
okay, good on you. Anything else?
You said in the question, honestly, about someone finding money.
Yes.
Could you make that a little precise? Could you make it?
Well, sure. I was in men's room, and I walked into
the men's room, and there was a wallet there, and it had $250 in it, Australian money, right, laying on a sink. And I picked it up, and I opened it. And I knew damn well that if I put that in my pocket, there was nobody in that meeting going to ever suspect me of taking it. Right? Nobody. Well, that's Jack Brennan. He wouldn't do that. They wouldn't even ask me, did I see it? And this went through my mind, because at the time, Uncle Sam is not too heavy with his disability money, you know. And by the time I get it over here, and by the time you Australians get a lump out of it for exchange rate, I wind up with nil. I was zilch, you see? So $250 I could have used. I could have used it.
But if you found a bill in the middle of the road and you send it there by yourself, what?
Oh, that's different. I would make every effort to find out whose it belonged to. I would make the effort. And if I couldn't find out who it belonged to, well, naturally I'd keep it. My mother didn't raise no stupid children, you know. But there are a lot of times that we can do things that are not completely dishonest, but they're not honest either. You know, that, and that's what we got to get rid of, that fair line in the middle there, see? And if there's a note in there or guy's name and address, you got to give it back to him. Don't keep it. That's what I'm referring to, see? Not taking the easy way out all the time. What else do we have? Anything? All right. Well, if that's it, you wanna knock it off now? I'm very happy to have been here. They want me to speak again tonight and tell my story. Is that right? That what you want? Okay, I'll do that tonight. And before I do that, I wanna thank whoever it was responsible for paying for my ticket. Come up here. He got it for me. I don't know where the hell he got it. I hope you didn't steal it, Mike. But wherever it is, because, you see, gratitude will strangle you just the same as hate will. See? And I'm full of gratitude. And I realize something, that if I don't get out to meetings and talk to people and help people as best I can, then my gratitude is going to start choking me, you see? And pretty soon I might die. So thank you all for having me here, and God bless you all.